हरिः ॐ
सहनावावतु सहनौ भुनक्थु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तमाविद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Yeah, page 56. One must act according to the religious principles that suit his constitutional position. It is not that everyone must adhere to the same type of religion. So Varnashram is the whole group of all the religious processes that are compatible to each other. And according to our nature, then we situate ourselves in the particular religion that matches us. Right? A general principle is that a poor man should not unnecessarily endeavor for economic development. One who refrains from such endeavors but who engages in devotional service is most auspicious. Right, so you're in a particular position from previous karma and all that. So then to unnecessarily endeavor. You make endeavor for it. So let us say that one had money, there was some particular mistake, impurity of mind or something like that, one ended up in a poor situation. But by putting in your honest endeavor, then things pick up very easily. So then what it picks up, then you follow that. But if you do your endeavor, it doesn't change, and then you try to do more endeavor to try to change, that's the unnecessary that you don't worry about. In other words, the karma is stronger than that. It's something more lasting. So therefore, just you put in your honest work, what you get from that, live off of that and be happy, but put your time into devotional service. That then is considered to be auspicious. So in other words, wherever one's situated in the system, if one puts in one's the natural effort and whatever results one gets, one lives off that and then uses the time for Krishna consciousness, that's considered proper. Right? You don't necessarily try to do more. Like you see Yudhishthira Maharaj, he had his kingdom, he just ran his kingdom. You never saw him trying to expand his kingdom. Right? But
he was the emperor of the world.
Yeah, but he could still harass. You know, Jarasandha goes out and, he's got, 20,000 kings imprisoned, like that. So he doesn't make that unnecessary endeavor. Does that make sense? So he just does it, it comes very easily. So that's what he does. So you don't focus on that, but someone like Jarasandha is always trying to expand, Kamsa is trying to expand, they're all trying to expand. So you see that as a major aspect. So that takes away from, the proper position. Does that make sense?
Another doubt.
Trying
to be scientific.
Yes, okay.
We have to... 8 hours of their day is supposed to be focused on the occupation.
Yes.
So it should be focused.
Yes.
When we say it should come easily,
it means what comes with that 8 hours of focus according to their ability. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like this. I told the story. I went to this one gentleman in Jamshedpur. He, at that time, I don't know about now, but at that time, he made all the bus bodies for every bus and truck in eastern India. That meant Bihar, Bengal, Assam, anything like that. And there's, when you go on the road, there's tons of trucks. So the guy had huge factories, so he was an incredibly wealthy man. You go to his office, he's not there. Oh, he comes at this time. Right? He comes at 10 o'clock. You know, I think I went there at 12. What? He's not there. Okay, he comes at 10. So, next day I came at 10. He walks in. As soon as he's walking in, he's talking. Their secretaries are coming out and this and that. And then he sits down. And he's talking literally on two phones at once. You generally see that as a comedy item. He was literally doing it. And guys are coming in, signing papers and all. It was like insane. You know, it'd be like, you know, Shastra saying he was doing things with, you know, 10 hands. That's what he was doing. And so I just, you know, sat there for 10 minutes and thought, well, this is insane. The guy, you know, I thought this was an abnormal day, you know. So then I thought, okay, I'll come back later, you know. So then I asked, you know, okay, you look to be busy now, which he was. Says, you know, I'll come later. What time? So he said, come at 4. So I came back. I'm sitting there at 4. He walks in, exactly the same thing. And that, but this time, because I didn't know what to do, I just sat there, you know. And after 20 minutes of total insanity, he just stopped all the phones, stopped all the secretaries, stopped. He had done all his work in 20 minutes. All the afternoon, you know, in other words, what he would do in the afternoon, the whole after lunch, he did it in 20 minutes. Same in the morning. So in 40 minutes, he ran, you know, one of the biggest trucking building, you know, how you say, you know, machineries probably in the world, you know. He did it in 40 minutes a day. And then as soon as he did, stopped, leaned back in his chair, okay, what can I do for you, you know, like that. And as long as we talked in that, there was never any other disturbance. No phone call, no secretary, nothing. You know, he had his rules. He's doing everything in that 20 minutes. And after that, nothing's going to happen. So how does people really have to organize that it happens in that time? And then he invited to the house. He goes, this and that. And really relaxed. Never any calls. Never any anything. Just. So that guy's, you know, one of the wealthiest guys in India in 40 minutes a day. So that's what we're saying is that you put in, according to your nature, your focus, you give it your best shot, and whatever happens in that amount of time. If you can do it less than 8 hours, better. But 8's like your maximum that's given. It's not like a maximum like, you know, this is over the top. It's a standard like that. If you can do it less, then hey, great. He would do it in 40 minutes. So, you know. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point. But I remember when I visited Germany, then I don't know about now, but this was back, when was that? In the 90s. If you weren't working two jobs a day, you just weren't German. You know, you were not respected. Maybe, okay, let me rephrase that. You were not West German. Maybe East German, you know, those guys just sit around all the time. But the West Germans, no. They had 16 hours a day. You did two jobs a day. Otherwise, how do you maintain and expand and take over the world on, you know, one job a day? So that's over endeavor, because then that only leaves them 8 hours to do everything else. And so definitely they're not going to get their rounds in. Mm-hmm. You know. Does that make sense? So that's the idea. So that's why it says, according to the religious principles, it is not that everyone must adhere to the same type of religion. So someone may work more, someone less. I remember one temple president, I think he did 2 half days of work a week. And that maintained him for the whole week. And so basically, he, you know, 6 days a week full were just, he did his service as the temple president. You know, like that. So like that, then you, everybody's an individual. So whatever it takes, their needs, their necessities, someone will be more, someone less, someone more time, someone less, so like that. Does that make sense? That's why it's saying is that the Varnashram system is can accommodate all that. Right? So, because in other words, let us say someone's doing more spiritual activity. So therefore, he's doing less economic development. Now, within the Varnashram system, that will be respected. But if it's not the Varnashram system, that's definitely not respected. You know, he'd be wasting his time. You're supposed to do that after you're 50 years old and your teeth fall out and you can't work anymore, and then your son's doing it. So then, okay, you retire and sit down and read your Bhagavad Gita. You know, is that... So that's the thing. Or if somebody's doing nice, they're developing and different things and has so much facility, it's not a problem either. I mentioned that the residents of, I think it was when Krishna came to Mathura, came into Dwarka. I think it was Dwarka. By how they were dressed and everything like that, you could tell everybody was basically well-to-do. So it's not a problem in the Vedic culture. You know, so you have all these residents, they're quite well-to-do. You have Sudama Brahman, who hardly has anything. And it's all good within the system. So because no one has to follow the same religion. Does that make sense? Yeah, because here religion means what's the inherent nature. So because inherent natures are different, therefore what they're following is different. But it's not made up. It's always according to Krishna. Oh, I just read, and Krishna's telling Sudama Brahman that it's his direct order that human beings have to follow Varnashram. It's not that he's put it out there as, you know, this is a nice thing to do or this or that. It's a direct order that you should do this. Like that. So the contemporary doubts about that, then that one sentence kind of removes that doubt. Yes.
They could still say, oh, that was just meant for Sudama Brahman. It's a direct order to
him. If you look at it and then later on it's reiterated and then Prabhupada makes a comment, and it would be really, really hard. It means if you want to establish yourself as a good, you know, how you say, word juggler, then hey, go for it. Then follow that religion. But then know that status and everything come along with it. You know? Yeah. Okay. One who is not satisfied with the mind must fall to degradation. One must conquer lusty desires, anger, greed, fear, lamentation, illusion, fright, unnecessary talks on material subjects, violence, the four miseries of material existence, and the three material qualities. One must conquer, yes.
Sometimes there's a satisfaction, but also an anxiety, like mental anxiety.
Yes.
So is that?
It just means that there's progress because there's some satisfaction. It just means those areas that are giving anxiety, they have to be analyzed. Is it something that is it connect, means, you know, is it something that you could say is connected with your duties and all that, so then it's something that by engaging in the Lord's service will be purified, or is it something that's unnecessarily there, and so one analyzes it, and, you know, with the practice of devotional service it can go. See, because let us say there's an anxiety coming up.
Yeah.
Now, is that coming up because it's necessary? You know, not saying it's never necessary, but is it something connected with something you're doing, or it's just something in the mind?
Most of the time it's just in the mind.
Yes. Now, here's the point, is it's coming up into the mind, what do you do with it? So if you just, yeah, that's the point. But if you just let it go, then it goes. In other words, whatever is there in the heart, because what's in the heart, the problem is this generally all this stuff, right? Lust, desires, anger, greed, fear, lamentation, illusion, fright, unnecessary talks on material subjects, violence, the four miseries, and the three modes. This is generally what seems to...
I don't know.
Is there or it's gone? Can it see? Is it purple?
I can't.
Does it
see.
Have lots of furry, hairy legs? And like that? Kind of orange eyes? Is it kind of like about this big?
I thought. I'm
scared. Yeah, no. Okay. So, those are what's in the heart. That's what's keeping us from pure devotional service. And it's kind of like you can say is, if one's in the material world, these things are going to be there to a more or lesser degree, depending upon where one is in the cycle of samsara, like that. And which direction is it? Some is there, but it's getting better, or some is there and it's getting worse, or, you know, like all this kind of thing. So by the chanting process, by the devotional process, all these things will come up because it's purifying. Like the example of a pond. It looks very clean, But at the bottom, there's lots of mud and stuff. So if you move the water, then it becomes cloudy. Right? So that's why it mentions about the heart of the devotee, like the crystal clear, because that means it is clear. It's not going to get muddy. So when these things come up, don't... In other words, just analyze how they're not very useful and how you're not interested. And then they'll go. You know? Does that make sense? And it's not necessarily that the whole package of one of those will go at once. It might, if there's very minimal, or it might take a, you know, more of that. But if we catch something and then get into it and then involve ourselves, then it doesn't go away. You know, it's like how you say, cleaning out the garage or something. You know, yes, it means you haven't looked at it for years, life has gone on perfect, and all that. So technically, you could just hire people to come in there, take it all away, and you never see it. But we don't do that. We have to look at everything. And then, wow, where is it? You know, and everything suddenly becomes important. So that's the whole thing, is that Maya just passes everything before our vision, before, you know, either what do you want to do with it? You're not interested, it gets thrown out. You're interested, it gets put back. Does that make sense? So, therefore, don't worry that these things are there. You know, we can worry that why, you know, how did we get ourselves here in the material world that these things are there? That's the thing, but that's because of our polluted consciousness. But the problem's not those things, actually. The problem is the lack of Krishna consciousness that those things can therefore prosper on. Does that make sense? So if we focus on devotional service, how to please Krishna, then these kind of things will go away. You know, just gradually. That's why we focus on the devotional service. We put in how much is necessary to take care of everything in a satisfactory way, and then balance time we put into Krishna consciousness. Yes.
In these cases, the biggest catch is that the mind tries to make you feel it, to identify with it.
Because we have. Why is it there? Means it's in the heart because we have identified with it. Otherwise, why wouldn't it be there? If we didn't do it, why would it be there?
The example is given, I heard one time, Shiva Maharaj and Guru Maharaj, they were discussing it. And they said that sometimes when, pride, when you get rid of pride, the feeling of it is considered to be like you're being like your skin is being peeled.
Skinned alive.
Yeah, while you're alive. Yeah. So that's why, naturally you don't identify with it, but you have to go through the.
You don't necessarily identify with it, but it's there because at one point you did identify with it. So if it comes up and you identify with it again, it will remain. It will give you trouble and remain. If it comes up now and due to purification from devotional service, you don't identify with it, it may give you trouble, but it'll go away.
Because you're identifying stronger in
it. Yes, because you're devoted. So you don't need that. You don't require that. Mm-hmm. You know, while for the materialist, it's like if you want to be situated properly in Varnashram, you don't actually require any of these bad qualities. But if you're situated in V-karma, then generally without these qualities, then how will you get ahead? The guy who, you know, it's more like the duck who can shout the loudest, not who, you know, quacking, who does quacking? You know, it's like, you know, in other words, the duck who can make everybody else's life the most miserable then, you know, gets ahead. Yeah. You know, does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, this is the objective of human life, means to get rid of these things, not to have them, right? One who has no faith in the spiritual master, who is identical with Sri Krishna, cannot get any benefit from reading Shastra. Pretty straightforward.
How will he get faith if he's not reading Shastra?
Association. But then you have to associate with those who have. But much of the time you see those who don't have faith in the spiritual master associate with those also who don't have that faith. And then because of that, they never get. And you generally find those individuals, much of the time, don't study Shastra anyway. Because it doesn't mean anything to them. time. Does that make sense? Or they may study and think that they're this, you know, the spiritual, like that. But they can't get any benefit. It means there won't be any realization. It doesn't mean that they don't gain knowledge, don't gain all these things. But actual Krishna conscious realization won't happen. Because for Krishna, if you're not connected with the devotees, then it's not going to work. So specifically, then you're connected with the spiritual master. And if that's there, then everything works very nicely. Wow. They got some serious machinery over there. Yeah. Wow. Okay. One should never consider the spiritual master an ordinary human being, even though the members of the spiritual master's family may think of him as such. Meditation and other processes of austerity are useful only if they help in advancement towards Krishna consciousness. So all these different things that one wants to do, if they help in Krishna consciousness, great. But if they don't, then what's the point? That's the whole thing, is you arrange your life that whatever you're doing is always going to help in Krishna consciousness. If that's done, then things work very nicely. So, yeah.
In Krishna consciousness on a larger scale or your spiritual life? Or both?
It means the point is how will you sustainably take part in the Krishna consciousness on the greater scale if you don't take care of yourself? I think it was Bhagavad. He was the president, and I think Janmashtami was coming up, and they were doing a big festival. I think his Prabhupada was there, so he's going out, getting up in the morning, eating something, going out all day, coming late at night, just, you know, eating, going back to sleep, like this, and he wasn't chanting. So after some days, Prabhupada asked him if he was chanting. And he said, no, because I'm so busy, you know, arranging all these things. And Prabhupada said, what's the point of arranging all those if you can't chant your rounds? And so in other words, if you can't, how will you save others if you can't save yourself? You know, that's... So you have to do... You do both. Okay. If they don't help, otherwise they are simply a waste of time and labor. For those who are not devotees, such meditation austerities cause fall down. Because they get involved in this, so they become puffed up. They get facilities and everything like that. From austerity, you get material facilities. From meditation, they'll get siddhis and all this. So they get all that, and then they fall down. Fall down from what? From Krishna consciousness. Right? It's not that they fall down from materialism. Not, you know, they're well situated in that. You know, like that. Does that make sense? Every householder should be very careful, because even though a householder may try to conquer the senses, he becomes a victim to the association of relatives and falls down. Thus, a grihastha must become a vanaprastha or sannyasi, live in a secluded place, and be satisfied with food gotten by begging from door to door. Right? Because one's going through family life and all the relatives, they all have what you should be doing. It means there's what you should be doing, and then there's what their idea what you should be doing, which means what you should be doing to make their life better. And so as Narad Muni mentioned before, you talk about, yes, great idea, and do your own thing. And if that doesn't work out, then suddenly it's like, you know, somehow your job opportunity or whatever it is in this place isn't working out, and somehow know that there's this fabulous opportunity on the opposite end of the country like that. And so what to do, you have to go and, you know, have to be practical in that. So, like that. So you make these rounds. But in any case, since one has to go through some amount of that, that's why then the grihastha, then they take up vanaprastha, so they can just detach themselves from this and focus on the direct devotional activities. That's then the idea. Okay. He must chant the Omkara mantra, Hare Krishna mantra, and in this way he will perceive transcendental bliss within himself. After taking sannyas, however, if one returns to the grihastha life, he is called a vantashi, which means one who eats his own vomit. Such a person is shameless. A householder should not give up the, you know, so we don't worry about it too much, but those who are traditionally follow Vedic culture, you know, from old families, this is such a big freak out for them. Like that. You know, it's like we have sannyasis like that, and it's not good and all that, but, you know, nobody really freaks out that bad. But I remember seeing one. They just can't believe it. It's not how could this happen? You know, how can you do this? And they never forget. They just can't drop it.
Many devotees also.
That's now, because as you increase the, you know, the more Hindu aspect, so that's the point. But they're coming in from Vikarma, not because sannyasa is such a... It's because it's a position that you have to do this, not that they would do this. You know, what I'm talking about are guys, they themselves follow all the rules, pukka. You know, very regulated, do everything, really things. They maintain themselves by traditional Vedic occupations. You know, Brahmins, like this, that's what I'm talking about. Not that people have their own sense of mundane morality and then they apply that, because that they do, but at the same time as then so many other things go on, and oh, but they're grihasthas, it doesn't matter. But in the Vedic sense, it does matter. You know what I'm saying? I don't mean that kind of thing. Because that, of course, people have authority issues, then they'll always find fault. This, what I'm talking about, is dharma issues, not authority issues. There's a difference. I've seen it in two people like that. They're so dharmic and all that. You know, real, you know, how you say? Yeah, just real old-fashioned Hindu, Bindu kind of like that. But pukka, and they just can't deal with it like that.
Concept of foreign
master. Yes, yes. And one of those was back in the 80s, early 80s. So they're dead now. The other one's contemporary. Okay. A householder should not give up the ritualistic ceremonies, and a sannyasi should not live in society. Right? So these two. So that's the point it's about. In other words, the sannyasi is not involved in them. The grihastha must be involved in them. If sannyasi is agitated by the senses, he is a cheater influenced by the modes of passion and ignorance. When one assumes a role in goodness by starting philanthropic and altruistic activities, such activities become impediments on the path of devotional service. Because we start these philanthropic and altruistic, where we're doing good work for everybody else. It's nice that such things are there in society. But for the devotee, that's not the prominent thing. Because teaching people Krishna consciousness, that's the highest welfare. Because then you're doing welfare for the soul. The other things are just basically for the body and mind. Let others do that. Does that make sense? In other words, those who function on that platform, let them do that work. But devotees, since they're working on platform, so they should do the higher welfare. Right? The best process for advancing devotional service is to abide by the orders of the spiritual master. For only by his direction can one conquer the senses. Right? So the idea is that senses are conquered, then one takes sannyas. That's the whole idea. That's why from the beginning, from Brahmacharya Ashram, one is trying to develop the mood of sannyas. Or what, everything's being done just for Krishna. And if that's obtained, then one either can take sannyas or not. One's already on the platform. But sannyas ashram is a opportunity that one can perform those activities and no one can expect you to do otherwise. That's the advantage. So only by the spiritual master's direction one can conquer the senses. Unless one is completely Krishna conscious, there's a chance of falling down. Of course, in performing ritualistic ceremonies and other fruitive activities, there are also many dangers at every moment. Fruitive activities have been divided into 12 portions. Because of performing fruitive activities, which are called the path of Dharma, one has to accept the cycle of birth and death. But when one takes the path of moksha, or liberation, which is described in Bhagavad Gita as Archana Marg, one can get relief from the cycle of birth and death. The Vedas describe these two paths as Pitriyana and Devayana. Those who follow the paths of Pitriyana and Devayana are never bewildered, even while in the material body. A monistic philosopher who gradually develops control of the senses understands that the objective of all the different ashrams, the statuses of life, is salvation. One must live and act according to the shastras. Right? So trying to get to the position of sannyas, that's what all the orders are for. They're all meant for that purpose, trying to develop that, I say. He understands the objective of all the different ashrams and status of life is salvation. So that's what we're trying to do. But the difference is we're using different mediums to attain that. Someone needs to engage more desires than that in that process, then that's what Grihastha ashram is for. Someone has less, then you have the brahmachari vanaprastha sannyas. That's the idea. But it's all to develop that mood that Krishna talks about in the 18th chapter of sannyas. Doing everything is naishkarmya, just to please Krishna. Right? So it's, so in other words, the whole point of the scriptures is pure devotional service. Yes?
Pitriyana Devayana?
I would expect more detail will come up later. Because how it's describing here, it says they won't be bewildered. Upcoming attractions. Yes. Yes. And one must live and act according to Shastra. So one studies the Shastra, one lives that way, one acts that way. Right? Acting others will see. Living may or they may or may not see. So that's the problem in the modern concept of social, you know, ideology, is that you only need to be ideal where people will see you. Because if you're not ideal, it will disturb society. But what you do in your spare time that nobody knows about, that doesn't really matter. Right? Does that make sense? But the Vedic concept is no. Whether you're with others, whether you're alone, whether you're just contemplating, whether you're doing things, in all situations you must be situated in, you know, the scriptures. So,
low level of integrity.
It is, but on these days that would be considered quite, how you say, but integrationally good. You understand? It says in the modern context, if someone, you all seeing them, they always do good, but at home they don't necessarily, you don't worry about it. Because the point is you don't hear about it, you don't see it, so there's nothing, it's just a theory. But if someone finds out about it, then it's a mess. So that's why then that warning is given. So in other words, you have, in the modern context, you have to run your private life in such a way that no one knows about it. And so if some people find out about it, it means you weren't that good. That's why everyone gets upset. Because you're not so good at the system.
And the Vedic concept, we invite people to our house.
Okay. That's there, but the point is it's when you're alone. The question comes down to, when you're alone and no one's looking, what do you do? Okay. So if you follow the Shastra, that's then, you know, living and acting according to Shastra. And if no one's looking and you do whatever you like, then, you know, hey, you know. You know, you go and look around and then, you know, do what you like. Then, you know. Does that make sense? Yeah. If one is performing the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, if one who is performing the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies becomes a devotee, even if he is a grihastha, he can receive the causeless mercy of Krishna. Even if he's a grihastha. Wow, yay.
Haribol.
Huh?
Here comes Haribol.
Yeah, this is Haribol. Yeah. You know, like that. The objective of a devotee is to return home back to Godhead, right? Because otherwise someone may say, no, but they're performing ritualistic activities and all this, but there's fruitive because they're grihasthas and this. How will they become devotees? But they're seeing everything in connection to Krishna, and so therefore even in that situation, there's not a problem. The objective of a devotee is to return home back to Godhead. Such a devotee, even though not performing ritualistic ceremonies, advances in spiritual consciousness by the supreme will of the personality of Godhead. One may actually become successful in spiritual consciousness by the mercy of devotees, or one may fall from spiritual consciousness by being disrespectful to devotees. In this regard, Narad Muni narrated the history of how he had fallen from the Gandharva kingdom. Oh, this is where that one is. Okay. And he was born in a Shudra family. And how, by serving exalted Brahmanas, he became the son of Lord Brahma and was reinstated in his transcendental position. Right. So here, reinstated in his transcendental position means the jiva comes back to the position of devotional service. Right? Does that make sense? After narrating all these stories, Narad Muni praised the mercy received from the Lord by the Pandavas. Maharaj Yudhishthira, after hearing from Narada, became ecstatic in love of Krishna. And then Narad Muni left that place and returned to his own place. Thus, Sukadeva Goswami, having described various descendants of the daughters of Daksha, ends the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Because that question was about them. So basically, this whole canto is describing that. But in that, then you get all these other aspects. Slokana Sharanam, summary of verses. Verses 1 to 35, attaining Brahminical qualities and beyond. So Brahminical, how do you say, what is it? Brahminical bhajan and beyond? Or, you know, the, okay, yeah, okay. 36 to 68, the paths of pravriti and nivriti. And 69 to 80, Narad Muni's prior experience as a Gandharva. Oh, it's not that many verses. Verses 1 to 35, attaining Brahminical qualities and beyond. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur writes in his commentary to verse 1, the 15th chapter describes all the rules for the householder and ends with a summary. In the previous chapter, the superiority of the Brahmana was described. Among the Brahmanas, there are gradations. The householder fixed in karma is a vipra. When he is fixed in austerity, he is a vanaprastha. When he is fixed in study and teaching, he is a brahmachari. When he is fixed in jnana yoga, he is a sannyasi. The word nishta should be understood to be included in each phrase. The latter are superior to the former in the list. So it's going through what's the natural position to be situated in. Right? So, is that what I'm saying? Yeah. So the whole idea is that among the describe the brahmanas, you know, it means grihastha in the brahmanas, and then of that, then what are the gradations within the brahmanas, and how all positions then one can be fixed in devotional service. Yes.
I don't understand how they came to that. Like, is this another one word, but it has a different meaning? All of them, but specifically one who studies and teaches is brahmachari. So how does that, is that the brahmachari that in the way that I would understand it, or is this another
saying? No, but you see, is brahmacharis, what do? They're studying, right? They follow the temple program, they study in that, and then they go out and preach all day.
But not everybody that studies and preaches is a brahmachari.
No. But the point is that kind of being fixed in that, he's fixed in study. That means these others are doing other things also. Right? It means that's all he does. Because before it mentioned, householder fixed in karma is a vipra. So vipra means a scholar. You know what I'm saying? So he studies, he does all his things, he does all his activities like that. But because of the wider range of it, it can tend to be more distracting. Not that someone in that position can't be more advanced. It's just the position itself isn't as ideal as then the other ones. Seeing that sense, the purpose is to get out of attachment to the material world. They're in a position that puts it farther towards being out of the material world. But ultimately, the point comes, if one's a devotee, then that's perfect.
Yeah.
So, but the word that's, that the point that's constant is the word fixed. So they're fixed in their specific duties, and that's what makes it glorious. So if one's fixed in devotional service, then wherever you want situated, then it's perfect. But it should be understood from this, then there's a hierarchy here.
Because Siddhama's he's a grihastha.
Yes. Okay. Yes, so that's a vipra there. But he's also very, very austere. He's almost like a vanaprastha, but not to that extreme, because he lives in his house.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have much facility. But a vanaprastha will tend to live outside the house.
Yeah.
You know, it's just when it gets too much sitting outside in the rain, you know, then he goes inside. But if it comes to the point where it doesn't bother him, he just sits outside. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a slightly different thing. But then here you're studying and teaching, then that's a better position than just you're being austere and performing your sadhana. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah, because then also the household, then he has so many things of his own that he has to take care of. Now he can be doing very nice devotional service and be well situated, but as far as what's going to get you more, then that's there. Then jnana yoga, the sannyasi, so he's seeing everything through that knowledge, how the super souls and how all these different things. They say, wah. Does that make sense? Yeah? So there must be that. So in other words, there's that natural respect that is there. That's what it has to be. Otherwise, then it's, oh, they're brahmacharis, it doesn't matter. But if they're situated nicely in preaching and that, they're actually in a senior position. Right? Does that make sense? Like that, yeah. Okay. The latter are superior to the former in the list. Narad Muni continued, "My dear king, that doesn't mean just the brahmachari and he's just new at it. This means the one who's situated. So this would most likely mean a brahmachari who's committed to the brahmachari ashram." Yes, senior brahmachari means, in other words, he's gotten trained and now instead of graduating and going on to grihastha, he will remain a brahmachari. So that's in that superior position. Just like... Yeah, like that. But you know, but even that, but he's committed to that. Just like in Bombay, then the grihasthas there were saying that the brahmacharis in the temple there, because they do all the activities that the sannyasis do, so they're just under the sannyasis in their respect for them. Right? And then naturally those who are senior in the grihastha community who are retired and engaged more in direct devotional activities and less in the household affairs, they're senior to them. So they follow this list just naturally. You know. But, you know, somebody, let's say, who's new in that, that's one thing. But the point is, once they're situated and going out and doing the preaching, then they're seen like this as superior to the grihasthas and vanaprasthas. But superior to that will be the sannyasis. Does that make sense? So it's a natural form. So when we say the grihastha is senior to the brahmachari, we mean the one who's not graduated, has not finished his vow. Right? Once he's finished his vow, then he either becomes a snataka and gets married, so now he's a respectable person of the community, or he decides to remain brahmachari, and then he becomes even more senior in the community. Does that make sense?
This particular point, you know, that you said about getting married, you know, a brahmachari when he gets married, it is not really respectful, at least that is missing in the ISKCON community.
That's just because of remnants left over from the brahmacharis back in the 70s and 80s, where it was, or mainly 70s, where it's, you know, considered a bad thing. But the point is we're working on the principle that brahmachari is good, and we're not using so much formality. It'd just be like, give an example. In the Oriental community, they have their martial arts system. Right? Yes? No? Okay. So, mostly we know about the Japanese system, where, you know, someone comes in and they're white belt, and then they move up through different colors, and then they get to whatever the top... like that. So they have a very formal thing like that. So that was there in Japan. In China, it wasn't. You just came in and you just learned. Someone learned quickly, someone learned slowly, someone like that. And so when you knew, you knew. So there was no designation as such. Does that make sense? So that was more the original system. But to make it so that people can be inspired and all that, they formalize like that. Does that make sense? So what Prabhupada instituted, it's not exactly formalized. So you don't have a formalized time of brahmacharya. And then after that time, then you decide, do you want to continue or do you want to get married? So if you made it that, okay, X amount of time, then you practice brahmacharya. Now if someone doesn't make it through that, then you could say that's not ideal, because they would lack training. So whatever we consider as proper training, then that should be the brahmachari ashram, right? Then when that's over, then if they want to get married, then that's not a problem at all. It should not be seen in that way. It just means now he's gotten trained, now he'll be a good grihastha.
Okay, then he should not take saffron in the first place.
That's there. That also, in India, then it wasn't until, I think, second initiation you wore saffron. Because generally they had been more mature, and so then they would decide to do like that. But in the West, just it was just everybody put on saffron, because in the West, saffron doesn't mean anything anyway.
Weird color.
Weird color?
For men.
For men? Yeah.
Pink is even better.
You know, it was kind of the rage the last few years. I think it's dying out now. You know, actual saffron was... all different accessories were all saffron and everything, and now it went into kind of a darker, kind of more burnt, you know, kind of orange and saffron, and now really burnt, and I think it's kind of burned out now. So that's the thing, is that, but then it has to be understood what it means and what it all does. But like you see, we're following that old tradition, is that those who in the future will get married, you know, those who are upakurvana, they always wear white. So the ones that are wearing saffron means they're committed to being brahmacharis. They've come to a mature position, and they're committed to being brahmacharis. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how many people follow that?
Because the brahmacharis, the saffron brahmacharis, who change the ashram, they themselves say that we have fallen.
Because the point is there's no end to the ashram anyway. The only option is naistika. What I'm saying is, unless we introduce upakurvana, you're not going to have that, glorious end to your brahmachari training. Mm. But we, like what we're doing, they like that, then they become snatakas, and then it's considered a glorious thing. Then they move on, and I think that everybody sees that properly. You understand? But the point is who follow? That's why Krishna says and Prabhupada says and the Acharyas say, follow the Vedic system, because it works so well, like that. So there, the brahmachari graduates and then, you know, goes on, then they see it as a good thing. You know, he gets married, then wow, okay, you know, he's nicely trained, now would be a good, like that. So that's why it's done in that way.
If this has been followed, then there'll be so less of gossip in the community itself.
No, they'll find something else to gossip about. But at least that aspect will be taken off the table. Gossip will always be there. That has to be there. That was already mentioned over here. Unnecessary talks on material subjects. It's just one of the anarthas that is just inherently there. It's just what gossip you're talking about, that's another thing, you know. And that's it. So don't worry. Don't. It won't be lost. Don't worry. Yes.
This is the first time we came across this naistika brahmachari. So he's just
the first time you come across a naistika
in this system.
Yeah, but even you see is that brahmacharis who are properly following and under, you know, respected, gurus, they're also respected in the community, like that. You know, when they come to the houses and things like that, then they're quite respected. So, in other words, in the Vedic system, everybody has respect for everybody else. Everything's respectable from one angle. So, that angle that's respectable, that's then what you focus on. So that's the point, is as it said that everybody has be following different aspects of religion. So it's not all the same. Therefore, but the principle of respect is always there. But what they're respected for is different. We have this one thing. We have this one standard. You have this, you're respectable. You don't have this, you're not. But there's all these different things of respect. You know, but there's always a gradation. Just like he gave here, these are all respectable positions, but there's a gradation. So just like all the principles of respect are there, but there's a gradation. So ultimately, the topmost is devotional service. So as one is advanced in devotional service, that's always, that tops anything.
So I have a...
But socially, then you would follow this. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So when they're in a system, generally they are like in an ashram. So that also requires some minimal management.
Yeah, you have to manage.
So then as these devotees, they have to do themselves. Then
it means who can manage yourself. Because management is a science. Brahmins can know any science and be able to apply it. So it's not that Brahmins can't manage. You know what I'm saying? Just like the king, he has ministers. Generally, they're Brahmins or very highly qualified if they're from other varnas. You know what I'm saying? So they're involved in it, but the point is it's the angle from which they're coming from it. But the Brahmins generally won't run the country. You have some examples, who was his name? No, one of the Alwars.
Kulashekar?
He was a king.
No, he was a king, but Kulashekar was a king. This is the other one. He was a Brahmin, and he came...
Yamunacharya.
So he was a Brahmin, but he became a king, but then he went back to his Brahminical things. You know? So that's all by the power of spinach. Right? So that's right. Lord Chaitanya, you know, puts that, makes that his, you know, a very prominent of spinach, yes.
What's the story?
What's the story? What is the story? It's a similar story like Astavakra, where he was young, he came for something, I think something happened to his father or something. And then he came to the king and challenged the local priest. I don't know, was that one Vandi or was the other one was Vandi?
His name is
Kolahar. Kolahar, the king?
The king's main debate was that...
That was Kolahar, okay. But then, so Vandi then was in the Astavakra one.
Okay.
So then he came, and he was young. And so then he took up the challenge. And so then... Alabandhu. That's the word. So then he said, okay, you know, so they'll have the debate. And so he said, who goes first? And so the other one, because he's senior, mature, you know, pundit, he said, you go first, because he's the kid, you know, so you get first chance. And so then he says, okay, explain to me how your mother, talking to the pundit, is barren, how the queen is unchaste, and I can't remember the third one.
How the king is...
sinful. How the king is sinful. So, the pundit was, I'd say, a bit taken back. He didn't know what to say. But the queen immediately, I think she stood up and shouted, Alabandhu, which means something like, he is victorious.
Yeah, he's victorious.
Like that.
Actually, both of them bet. King and the queen bet.
So he was on the his priest and she was on the yeah, and so she said, you know, she understood immediately, and so the pundit says, I have nothing to say, you know, but he was saying, but these are very strange questions, so, you know, I'm not going to accept defeat on points that can't be answered, so unless you can answer them, then you're automatically defeated. Means by bringing up a bogus argument. Just, you know, it's just like in law, if you bring up a bogus case, you'll be punished for doing it. Not that you, okay, well, I tried, you know. Like that. It's like, so then he said that his mother is barren because he was the only son. And it's considered that until the mother has two children, then she's sumangali, then she's considered she's with the child. Because otherwise, if one dies, she'll have none. So that was the one. The queen is unchaste because at the marriage ceremony, then you say that, Soma has given you to Gandharva to Agni, and Agni has given to me for frustration. So that means she's already been with three other men before getting to her husband, the king. And the king's sinful because he takes tax, so he takes on a sixth of the karma of all the citizens, so therefore he's sinful.
And spinach?
Hmm? Spinach. Okay. You're more interested in the spinach part. Okay. Okay. We're getting to the spinach. So I'm not sure how it worked out, but he gave him a kingdom. So then he was managing this kingdom and all that and going on for a long time and absorbed in kingly stuff. And then I think it was the guru. Huh?
His grandfather.
Okay. So the grandfather, they sent that because when he was a kid, there was a certain spinach he really liked, but it's a kind of more rare. You find it out in the forest. So because they live out there, they get it, but living in the city, you won't get that. So the Brahmin would come, the servant would come, he'd bring all this spinach, give it to the cook, and say, cook this for the king. He really likes the spinach. You know, so it's checked and this and that, so it's good. So they cooked it for the king. King was surprised. Oh, wow. Okay. You know, he liked it. And then every day he'd bring the spinach and just give it, go away. And so then after, you know, some time, I'm not sure how long, but I think it was months or something. Then one day he didn't come, you know. And so then immediately king is, where's the spinach? And the guy, and they called the cook, and why didn't you make the spinach? He says, the guy didn't bring it. He says, what guy? So then the next time the guy came, they brought him before, and then he discussed all different things, this and that, reminded him of his Krishna consciousness, so then he went back to, like
his
that.
Your grandfather left a lot of treasure for you.
Okay.
So he takes to Sri Lanka.
Okay. Okay, so that's the wealth.
Yes. On the way, he tells the stories of Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, okay.
And when he reaches, he understands what he left.
What he left, okay. Yeah, so, like that. Yeah, Shri's have very nice, clear, clean stories. Really straightforward. Like that. So that was Yamanacharya. He was the guru of Ramanujacharya. But he was the last of the Alwars. Right? He's not countermanded the Alwars. Oh, so
actually his grandfather is the one who compiles all the Alwars.
Oh, okay, so they have been already lost by that time. Oh, because this is thousands of years later then.
Yes.
Okay, so this is that. Because the Alwars were all there, they were basically all contemporaries. And then all these verses got lost. And so then
his grandfather.
Nathamuni. Then he, I guess in meditation and all that, it was all revealed and he wrote down, but according to who wrote what and all that, and then that was given to, I guess, Yamanacharya gave it to Ramanujacharya. So Ramanujacharya, for them, three things are main in their study, is the songs of the Alwars, the Vedanta Sutra, and I think Vishnu Purana. Like that. This is their main central study.
Divya Prabandhas.
That's the songs of the Alwars. Yeah, Divya Prabandhas.
He says Nam Alwar revealed.
Nam Alwar
revealed.
Nam Alwar came and revealed them. Okay. It's been a long time. I used to hear these all regularly back in the 80s, but since then our pundit is not with us, so I don't hear the stories anymore. Maybe. We have to talk to Nathamuni. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we're good with all this. Now, why things are superior, or, you know, why things are... All these are good, but then the thing point is it says the superior to the Brahman is described, and then amongst Brahmins there's gradation. So it's already superior, but amongst superior there's more superior. So, okay, yeah. So it's not that, okay, the sannyasis and then the grihasthas on the bottom of the pile here. No, they're already in the category of superior Brahmins. Right. Nard Muni continued, "My dear king, some brahmanas are very much attached to fruitive activities. Some are attached to austerities and penances. Still others study the Vedic literature, whereas some, although very few, cultivate knowledge and practice different yogas, especially bhakti yoga. A person desiring liberation for his forefathers or himself should give charity to a Brahmin who adheres to impersonal monism, jnana nishta. In the absence of such an advanced Brahmana, charity may be given to a Brahmana addicted to fruitive activities, karmakanda. So in other words, someone who's on the path of renunciation, they'll be considered better for how you say? How you say, material benefit than those who are attached to material benefit. Right? But of course, then the one who's attached to bhakti, that's the highest. Right? Because he's mentioning about the liberation of the forefathers. Because if you're worshipping demigods, then karmakanda brahmins is standard. But for the Pitri Puja, then it's always going to be someone who's on the path of nishkam. That's always your best, like that. Because otherwise it's... You know, yeah. Srila Prabhupada comments, there are two processes by which to get free from material bondage. One involves jnanakanda and karmakanda, and the other involves upasanakanda. Vaishnavas never want to merge into the existence of the Supreme. Rather, they want to be everlastingly servants of the Lord, to render loving service unto Him. In this verse, the words antyam ichata refer to persons who desire to achieve liberation from material bondage and merge in the existence of the Lord. Right? So one may ask, why is Narad Muni describing it like this? Because this is generic. Because people from these particular materialistic positions, they're actually pious. Right? And those who are pious, by association, they can become devotees. Does that make sense? So starting from this position, because as Krishna mentions, you can't be a devotee, then at least be one of these guys. Does that make sense? Right. And then from there, you can move up. So it just sets the standard in the society. So when we talk about universal, the Vedic is actually universal because it will accommodate both those who are theistic and those who are, devotional and those who are materialistic. You know, and within materialism, who's into karma and into jnana? Because on the material platform, these two don't really get together very well, right? So, therefore, then the Vedic is the only actual universe that can accommodate all these. That's why it said that everybody follows according to their own position. Right? So, devotees, however, whose objective is to associate personally with the Lord, have no desire to accept the activities of karmakanda or jnanakanda. For pure devotional service is above both karmakanda and jnanakanda. Anyavi lashita shunyam jnana karmadya navritam. Bhakti rasamrita sindhu 1.1.11. In pure devotional service, there is not even a pinch of jnana or karma. Consequently, when Vaishnavas distribute charity, they do not need to find a Brahmana performing the activities of jnana, kanda, or karmakanda. The best example in this regard is provided by Advaita Goswami, who after performing the Shraddha ceremony for his father, offered charity to Haridas Thakur, although it was known to everyone that Haridas Thakur was born in a Mohammedan family, not a Brahmin family, and was not interested in the activities of jnana, kanda, or karmakanda. Right, so in other words, the devotee, he is automatically the perfection of both. All his activities are all for the Lord. All his knowledge is in connection with the Lord. So the devotee is on that. So for the devotee, they just have to worry about devotees. But it's not that the particular activities or different things like that aren't being done. Does that make sense? That's the problem. It's because we're not interested in karmakanda, so we don't do any of the pious activities that are recommended. Well, because the Shastra is not that, okay, all these pious activities are recommended, but people are doing them because of the material benefits they'll get. But if you're going to do devotional service, you're going to offer things to Krishna. Okay, what's going to get, and what are you going to offer to Krishna? Right? Nice things. What gets nice things? Pious activities. Therefore, the devotee is doing the pious activity because it'll give offerings to please Krishna. He's not interested in himself. So he's on the platform of nivritti, of renunciation. Even though it appears, that's why devotional position is so confusing. We want to just say, oh, it's clear, you don't do any of this, you don't do nothing, you just sit down under a tree, great. But the whole point is that if it's connected to Krishna, it's perfect. It's not connected to Krishna, it's mundane. Right. Does that make sense? Yeah. Narada Muni continued, during the period for offering oblations to the demigods, one should invite only two Brahmins, and while offering oblations to the forefathers, one may invite three Brahmins. Or in either case, only one Brahmin will suffice. So in other words, if you can't, it means looking for quality persons, then two or three. And if you can't find that, one is enough. So it's not volume that makes it work, it's quality that makes it work. So, yeah. Even though one is very opulent, one should not endeavor to invite more Brahmins or make various expensive arrangements on those occasions. Because it's not about that, because everybody will be into the arrangements. But the point is it's about, in this case, it's about the demigods of the forefathers. So you don't want to distract. So in other words, what things will make that part of it nice, you do. But the other things, it's not. Does that make sense? Right. Because these aren't about social aspects. There are social, that's, you know, facilities. But these ones aren't for that. These are for proper performance of the ritual, proper consciousness, everything like that. If one arranges to feed many brahmanas or relatives during the Shraddha ceremony, there will be discrepancies in the time, place, respectability, and ingredients, the person to be worshipped, and the method of offering worship. Right? So that's why you don't do more. So that's, in this case, this is the original less is more. Right? You know, you think it's a new... No, Narada Muni is describing that specifically. That's why you stick to two or three, what's recommended, and if not, then one. And that's it. You know, not to, oh yes, we did, we fed 500 Brahmins. And no, it's not about that. Because as soon as you boast about what you did, the benefit's lost. So if there's only one Brahmin, and yet there's no special arrangements except for the offerings themselves, and you know what's necessary part of the ritual, that you're not going to be bragging about. You understand? So you won't lose that. Because the point is these things are for someone else. So the worship of the forefathers is for their benefit. But if you're bragging about it, it's lost, and then they don't get anything. So that's why these things are arranged like that. Okay, footnote 21. If many relatives are invited, the respect to the Pitris will be overlooked. Sardartha Darshini 7:15.4. Because everyone will be talking this and that, and then because all the relatives, then who's wearing what, who's doing what, and you know, who's with who, and that's with that, and I heard this was that, and who's that, and you know, like that, you know, and all that kind of jazz like that that goes on. Means it's just, you know, all we have to do is rewind back 1 week ago and think about what went on then, and then you can understand fully what we're talking about. Right? Because we just had two big weddings in the last week, right? So, yeah, so then it's all about that, who's sitting where, why they're there, why and this one this and that, and just on and on and on.
Pitris, they don't want to be updated?
No. That's strangely enough, it's amazing. They don't. It's just, it's real, I don't know, it's just, I guess it's one of those been there, done that, you know, so, yeah, so. Yeah, so the point is what he's bringing out is the Pitris will be overlooked because it'll be about taking care of the relatives and that. But here, it's just about the ritual itself and taking care of that one or three Brahmins or two Brahmins that come for the program. So everybody's focused on them. But if it becomes a social thing, then you have to take care of all the guests and that. It's natural, you have to. So then what will happen is the Pitris will be overlooked. So you can see again here, we're still going on about the Pitri thing. It's the most complicated of all the things. You know, it just goes on and on and on. That's why then we're so fortunate. Then we just, you know, chant Hare Krishna and, you know, feed. But at the same time is this whole thing of feeding, you know, 3,000 devotees and then doing a bad job. It still applies. Better to invite a few devotees to your house, do a nice job, and just focus on them, that still applies, even if it's Vaishnavs. Because then the point is it's Vaishnavs, but then how many coming there get served properly, right? You come there, you stand outside, you have to wait all that time. It should be that you're the special guest if you're coming for the, you know, eating for the Shraddha, right? You know what I'm saying? If it's not part of the ceremony, you just want to feed the devotees, then great. That you do. But as part of the ceremony, then it's not. One should not do it.
Maharaj?
Yes.
Like even Lord Chaitanya, he performed the Shraddha ceremony of his father in Gaya.
Yeah.
And same way, like many of them performed in Gaya also, all the devotees. So it's
yes, like, yes. Yeah. But the point is if you're doing in Gaya, who's there? Right? Means Lord Chaitanya went there. Were there any relatives?
No.
Was there any social program? Mm. No, so it was just him and the Brahmins. That's it. You understand? That's the point. So you can go there and do it. You can do it. Generally, it's that first one's done there like that, or one is done there. Mm-hmm. But after that, you don't go there every year for it.
Not every year, once in
a lifetime. Yeah, so that's the point. It's done. If you can do, then nice. It's not a bad thing. But it's not that if you don't do it, there'll be a problem. But you shouldn't say, there's no need, and that's nonsense, and that's Maya. No, it's a standard thing. But at the same time, as if you can't get there, or this and that, then don't worry about it.
Because it isn't said that when we offer the pinda to the Vishnupadi over there, then the Pitris, they get liberation.
Yes, but you're chanting Hare Krishna, that also liberates them and another, you know, how you say, nine generations before them. Well, actually, no, because Pitris will be three back, so then that will be seven before them. Right, so take your pick. You know what I'm saying? So if you do that also and you're a devotee, it's not a problem. But it's not that it's necessary the superior thing to do, but it's not something to not do. It's a standard thing. Right? Does that make sense? But if going there the Brahmins are really annoying, then we may just avoid it. Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, it's like, what is it, going to Govindaji in Jaipur? Brahmins never bother you. It's always a nice program. You know, but you come with something, they're always very helpful and come and give you darshan and like that. But they don't bother you. Like that. You know, so places where they bother you, you know, you can decide to go or not. Okay. When one gets the opportunity of a suitable, auspicious time and place, one should, with love, offer food prepared with ghee to the deity of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and then offer the prasad to a suitable person. Notice it says ghee. Okay. A Vaishnava or a suitable person, a Vaishnava or a Brahmana.
Olive oil doesn't go?
No, it doesn't mention olive oil. Strange.
It says the wrong Pitris.
Yes, yes. The Pitris that are being under Yamaraj's hospitality are being squeezed through oil presses. Those are the ones that you offer olive oil to. Yeah. Yeah. But the ones that are sitting there, you know, in Yamaraj's court, you cook with ghee. Mm. That's what was. We'll see about, I think it's ninth canto, Urvasi.
Yes.
Yeah. That was what her condition. If she's going to, be married to the king, she never eats anything that's not. You can't cook something that's not using ghee. You use oil, that's it. She's leaving. Yeah. That, what do you call it? That's a deal breaker. That one, yeah.
Standard.
Hmm?
Standard,
yeah. Okay. This will be the cause of everlasting prosperity. So, cooking something in ghee, offered to the Supreme Lord, offering then to Vaishnava or qualified Brahman, as mentioned before, that will give everlasting prosperity. Now, what's the big deal? That is, in Pitri Puja, that is the term you're looking for. As we mentioned, something will give 1 year, 2 years, you know, like this, up to 12 years, and then there are things that will give everlasting. So the smart ones go for the everlasting, the dumb ones go for the other ones. Right? Because the dumb ones are generally into meat eating, so therefore then that's why they go for those things. You know, it's like how often do you get the opportunity to have porcupine for lunch, you know? Yes?
It's a bit off the topic, but Russians, they offer a glass of water.
When you're doing the... Yeah, that's the Kutri Puja. No, you go down to the, you know, the grave, you put some flowers, you put the thing, you put two glasses, of course, you pour one, you know, the other, and say all the things, and this and that, and do they leave the glass there and go?
Yeah, okay. The bread and the glass should be there.
Okay. And, and then who comes along and drinks it?
The bum.
The bum, okay.
That's how much better
they do. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so they must hang out a lot at the cemetery.
Yeah, they're just around.
Okay, yeah.
End of the day.
Then you make your rounds to see. Yeah, so when you're doing things, always the things that are generally considered, you know, connected with ghosts and things like that, then you may have these kind of things in those ceremonies like that. But generally, that end of it gets pretty grungy. Because there's five levels of Tantra. So we follow Sattvika Tantra, you know, Vishnu Tantra, that's the top level. But there's four levels below that, and so when you get right to the bottom, then it'll be all that stuff. You know?
So it's kind of still according to some type of ritual?
Yeah, no, it is. It is according to some kind. But the point is you're dealing with ghosts, not that. Forefathers aren't nicely situated with Yamaraj. That means they're not situated with Yamaraj in a prestigious position. Yeah, like that. You know, so. But, you know, I'm sure that they're happy, you know. So everlasting prosperity means you can get the maximum benefit from that. So they can say, no, okay, that's nice, but you get more benefit. No, it mentions everlasting. So that means you won't get better than that. Okay. One should offer prasad to the demigods, the saintly persons, one's forefathers, the people in general, one's family members, one's relatives, and one's friends, seeing them all as devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. See, so we're carrying on with that about all the debts that you have. So all these persons must be taken care of. A person fully aware of religious principles should never offer anything like meat, eggs, or fish in the Shraddha ceremony. And even if one is a Kshatriya, he himself should not eat such things. Right? So there is opportunity you can do, but the reason that this there is because there's people who are going to do it anyway. So therefore the Vedas then regulate, so then these are the methods. Only these animals, only these kind of situations, that you know, the mantras, everything like that. So then it regulates. As we say, it's on the lowest level. Mm-hmm. But someone who is, you know, serious about that, they won't do any of this. Like that. When suitable food prepared with ghee is offered to saintly persons, the function is pleasing to the forefathers and the Supreme Lord, who are never pleased when animals are killed in the name of sacrifice. Persons who want to, because, well, the animals are also part and parcel of the Lord, so why they should, you know, die for the forefathers. Forefathers aren't into that too. That's why it mentions cooked in ghee, and we mentioned that they offer the prayer, when will I have a descendant who will offer me sweet rice, you know, that's been cooked and all that, and then offered. Okay. Persons who want to advance in superior religion are advised to give up all envy of other living entities, right? So if you're interested in inferior religion, then hey, go for it. But yes?
Regarding the pitris. And like we offer it to the Lord and then we offer it to the pitras.
Yes.
We give it to the crow of the cow. So when we give it to the crow, does it mean that the pitris come in the form of crow to receive it?
No, the crows carry it. It's just like the Brahmin eats, but the benefit of it goes to the pitris, not to them. That's why then, you know, they can't do so many things after that. They have to maintain purity and everything like that until the next morning. Right. So, I mean, in other words, they won't go to the Pitri Puja and then decide that night they're going to do Garbhodan Samskar. Otherwise, that Brahmin, the family member, the forefathers, everyone falls down into hell. So, no, it's very strict on, that's what we're saying. Of all the rituals, it seems to be the most strict on something that's for everybody to do. It means I'm sure Rajasuya sacrifice is much more complicated. But that's a rare thing, and it's an optional thing. It's kamika, but these are all part of the, you know, the regular activities for householders. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Persons who want to advance in superior religion are advised to give up all envy of other living entities, whether in relation to the body, words, or mind. There's no religion superior to this. Because of an awakening of spiritual knowledge, those who are intelligent in regard to sacrifice, who are actually aware of religious principles, who are freed from material desires, control the self in the fire of spiritual knowledge, or knowledge of the absolute truth. They may give up the process of ritualistic ceremonies, right? So if you're absorbed in spiritual life, then this whole thing that he's described in this chapter, parts in the last chapter, I'm not even sure there wasn't a little bit in the one before, like that if you're situated and focused on devotional service and that's your thing, then this is not necessary. But if you're not, it's imperative. Anybody who's not practicing, determining, you know, pure devotional service, it's imperative that they do this. And if they're not doing it, they're going to get trouble for this. You know, so it's not a matter, oh, we don't believe in that, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. Does that make sense? Yes.
Situated in pure devotional service means...
means that that's their purpose.
That's the goal.
That's the goal. Yes. But the point is, it has to be on that. It can't be that, you know, sometimes that, but they're absorbed in all kinds of material things and not really, and then think, I don't have to worry about all the ritualistic activities. So, and the activities that I am performing are for sense gratification. So, you know, if one's just hearing and chanting and doing your service and all that, whether you're advancing nicely or not, then you're in the category you don't have to do all this. But if instead of doing the recommended activities and that business of someone who's interested in pure devotional service, one is doing whatever one feels like because he feels like it, then the problem comes is then why you're not doing this. So since they're not going to do that, then take up pure devotional service because they're definitely not going to do this. You know, they can't even get it together to, you know, how you say, you know, wash their hands after eating something in the kitchen while they're cooking. You know, so let alone, how you say, worry about this stuff. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So you have to remember is that the range of what we're discussing here is going from qualified Brahmins down to qualified antyajas. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Srila Prabhupada comments, people are very much interested in karmakanda ritualistic ceremonies for elevation of the higher planetary systems. But when one awakens his spiritual knowledge, he becomes uninterested in such elevation and engages himself fully in the jnana yagya to find the objective of life, right? So that means he gives that up. So the jnana yagya is actually, that's the path, that's the sannyas path. Right, so that means the Nivriti path is followed by all devotees. Now, whether within that Nivriti path you're following Pravriti or Nivriti, that's another thing. So one might be a Grihastha, but it's about that knowledge about Krishna coming to that platform. Does that make sense? That's why we have the parallel, is that it's sometimes it'll be discussed in a general form within within Pravriti. Of Pravriti Nivriti, you know, for the materialist, the karmas, jnanis. But we'll be counted within Nivriti, but we're not the Nivriti of the jnanis. But the paths look, the methods are the same. The consciousness is different. So as you change the consciousness, then some details of the process aren't important. Right? So when we say we don't, they may give up the process of ritualistic ceremonies. That doesn't mean we give up evening and Mangal arti, because those are devotional service. But we'll say no, but it's a ritual. So the point is we have to be able to move beyond, you know the meaning of words, not just that the word is there. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
The spirit of the law.
Yeah, the spirit of the law, not the, and even that they're not good lawyers anyway. But so. The objective of life is to stop completely the miseries of birth and death and to return home back to Godhead. When one cultivates knowledge for this purpose, he is considered to be on a higher platform than one who is engaged in karma kanda, or fruit of activities. Right? Because then he's on the path of liberation. But he's on the dynamic path or the sustainable path of liberation. The jnanis aren't, you know. Narad Muni continued. Upon seeing the person engaged in performing the sacrifice, animals meant to be sacrificed are extremely afraid, thinking, this merciless performer of sacrifices, being ignorant of the purpose of sacrifice and being most satisfied by killing others, will surely kill us. Right? So, we just attribute the dumb animals. Dumb means they're not really into philosophy. But this point here is not philosophy. They just do eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That they know very nicely. You know, just they have their own language to discuss all these things. Right? Does that make sense? We have a very wide language because we can discuss on 8,400,000 species. They only need to discuss in one species. So therefore, it's much more simpler for them. But it's not that they don't think all these things. That's the point why the Shastra reveals. Otherwise, it's they don't think anything. No, but they think all this. It's that, you know, why you've been taking care and now you're going to kill me? What's going on here? You know, because they relax. They become domesticated. So then, technically, they're part of the family. Though, you know, they're not saying they want to live in the living room. They're happy to live out in the shed, you know. But the point is, they're part of the family. That's what Narad Muni mentioned before. The grihasthas, all these living entities are part of the family. Therefore, then to kill them, then they're going to think badly. You're going to disappoint them. That's why there's karma. That's why there's a reaction. Does that make sense? Yeah. In this regard, Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur quotes from the Rig Veda 10:82:7. You do not know the person who has produced these creatures, who dwells within you, surrounded by ignorance, uttering mantras to maintain themselves. The priests carry out their actions. Right? So they don't know the super soul. They're just going through the actions and all that, so they don't catch. That's the problem. Okay? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki.
Jai.
Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.